This week on Your Western Context, Alberta resentment against Bill C-69 is growing. BC was warned of money laundering 20 years ago, and we find out more about the roots of liberal corruption with SNC-Lavalin. Also, Trudeau slams a flood volunteer as unfriendly and unneighborly. This is Western Context, episode 117, recorded Saturday, May 4th, 2019. Flooding concerns. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are back once again this week.
Good to be back, as always, as we start the month of May, and as warmer weather is starting to go everywhere, I think, in Canada at this point. It's good that things are getting nicer, but definitely lots in the news that isn't being getting nicer, that's for sure. Lots that hasn't been covered fairly in the media, and lots that has been missed, I think.
Indeed, and that's what we've been talking about since January 2017, and we're going to continue to do that for the foreseeable future here at Western Context. If you're joining us for the first time, we are a podcast that aims to cut through all the bias and sensationalism that you find in the mainstream media, and we also aim to provide all the information and context necessary to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So we're going to start with our Alberta story this week, and you know, last week we covered the coming change in government, and this week that happened on Tuesday. The new UCP government was sworn in, and the cabinet got to work right away. First order of business was to proclaim Bill 12, which was the BC turn off the taps legislation that we've talked about numerous times in the past here on the podcast. And, you know, looking at this cabinet, it's a cabinet that's full of experience, including a finance minister who has experience as a professional accountant, an education minister who is a former school trustee, and an energy minister who has worked with pipeline and oil and gas companies before as a lawyer, and an agriculture minister that actually has a deep experience of farming. So there are lots of people in this cabinet that have been assigned portfolios that definitely fit their professional skill set. Now, Premier Jason Kenney has also been busy this week, so much so that he's already had his first face-to-face meeting with Justin Trudeau in Ottawa and has testified in front of the Senate on Bill C-69. That's what we're going to be talking about this week. And the headline here is that Kenney taps separatist angst, blasts C-69 as senators scramble to amend sweeping energy reforms bill. So Bill C-69 is what people in the media and the pipeline advocates have been calling the No More Pipelines bill. It effectively overhauls the National Energy Board. And in this overhaul, it will drastically increase the amount of review that is needed for energy projects, including taking into account potential carbon output of the energy that's being carried, not only in its creation while it's in the pipe, but also any products that the energy would result from after it leaves the pipe and carried on to consumers. Now, the new hurdles here in this bill would significantly stifle investment and lower investor confidence within the Canadian energy sector because, ultimately, regulations are seen as red tape, which simply doesn't exist elsewhere in jurisdictions like North Dakota and Texas, just to name a couple. And when Jason Kenney was talking at the hearing, he said that this is not just a slight against the people of Alberta. This is the culmination of a full frontal attack on our economic prosperity. I plead with you as federalists to understand the national unity implications of this. And we talked about this last week on the podcast, that this entire issue is indeed heading towards a national unity crisis, and it seems as though the federal government is perfectly content to campaign on this. Now, after the hearing, he spoke with reporters, and he made the point that if polls were showing 50% of Quebecers would be toying with the idea of separation, as some recent polls have shown here in Alberta, the federal government would indeed take them seriously and would not pass such a bill as Bill C-69 that has been passed by the House of Commons and is now up for review in the Senate. He also told reporters that more and more Albertans are asking, why are we being dealt with so unfairly? The bill will feel a deep and growing sense of resentment and alienation. It's the role of the Prime Minister of any party to safeguard national unity, and these bills undermine national unity. The line has been drawn in the sand that should Bill C-69 pass in its current form, that Alberta will ultimately trigger a referendum on equalization to make it more fair or completely remove it from the Canadian Constitution. This is what Jason Kenney said following the hearing this week. Now, recall previously that this threat of a referendum on equalization was focused on if there are no new pipelines built by 2021. Well, we can see here that with this bill being passed, the rhetoric has been toned up on this. Now, Jack Mintz, writing in the Financial Post, also summarized that the situation may not be as easy to resolve as some may think, in particular how the Quebec separation issues were resolved. He boils it down to conflicts of taste versus conflicts of claim. Conflicts of taste ultimately revolve around differences in political preference, and this is largely what Quebec's focus was on while they were looking at separation. This, of course, means different cultural values, different political values, and a desire to have government close to home, so to speak. Whereas conflicts of claim resolve over disputes such as sharing the wealth, which is what we're seeing here in regards to Alberta. And these are ultimately harder to resolve for Alberta because Alberta is called on to contribute and support provinces such as Quebec, which are larger by population but are in general by GDP poorer and take transfer money and equalization in from the federal government. Quebec also yields more power electorally, both in the federal House of Commons and the Senate, as well as having provincial governments that are hostile to natural resources projects. This is why in the 1990s, the West, including Alberta, advocated for a Senate with equal representation for all of the provinces, so that a Senate, as is it doing now, would be able to stand up and review Bill C-69 as it focused primarily to the interests of Alberta, Saskatchewan, and other resource-producing jurisdictions within the country. Now, this ultimately means that it's required for the federal government to avoid top-down policies, and it instead should seek to cooperate with provinces on regulations, as we're seeing here that they're not doing with Bill C-69, carbon pricing, forcing a carbon tax or whatnot on various provinces such as Saskatchewan and Ontario. It remains to be seen if they will force that same carbon tax on Alberta once the UCP government here repeals the former NDP government's carbon tax, and ultimately fiscal policy as a whole to avoid these conflicts of claim. And as we see here, this list of bullet points that Jack Mintz pointed out is exactly everything that the Trudeau government is not doing to mitigate these problems. Mintz also proposed that the federal government could revamp the equalization program to better help provinces like Alberta and Saskatchewan that often face sharp revenue declines due to fluctuating prices of natural resources. He also guesses that Alberta could push for federal cash transfers to be converted into personal tax points to give the province a bigger share of their personal income tax, effectively letting the province have more control over its tax system as happens in Quebec. And the reason for this is because it's the tax regime which attracts investment and skilled workers to Alberta, and that's what Alberta wants to compete on. They want to be able to compete with the likes of North Dakota and Texas in order to draw that skilled labor in and build the economy so that there is a strong enough economy that when oil prices fall, we're not left scrambling for a solution. Now, this could be talked about constructively during the federal election this fall, but as we said previously last week on the show, the federal government seems all too happy to campaign on a unity crisis, and of course the media will follow along as it generates the likes and clicks that provide them with their modern-day ad revenue.
Yeah, exactly. The media doesn't really dive into this issue very deeply. On it, they look for the quotes from both sides, and they'll go with that, and then they'll just go with what the surface level argument is. But when you dig down deeper, it's clear that there is a huge deep-seated resentment for what the federal government has done to Alberta, not just in the present, but what has happened in the past. And things like equalization that were pushed through the renewal by the Trudeau government just in the past couple of years, with no review or no changes at all to make up for declining natural resource prices, I think has definitely seen a lot of you could say alienation in Western provinces, especially in Alberta, where a lot of that lion's share of equalization is actually coming from. And what seems like a disregard for Albertans and what they're going through, especially ones in the natural resource industry, has definitely created a unity crisis. And I think that Jason Kenney's new government is going to probably try and keep going on that to try and push the federal government for more of these resource projects and for more help.
And, you know, when it comes down to it, it's a two-piece solution. Obviously, you know, there is the orange stamp we talked about during the election campaign, where the color of orange that the NDP is effectively seen as a big orange weight that stymies investment. And then on the other hand, you have these kind of regulatory burdens put on by Bill C-69. It is a two-step process for Alberta to return to prosperity on this. And this is something I think that the new premier obviously understands, because that was the mandate that he was elected on. And, you know, it is a time in which governments need to listen to the people, because as we talked about before, there have been polls that have said that there are, you know, upwards of 50% of the population in Alberta that would entertain the idea, or at least think of leaving Canada. And obviously that's not what anybody wants to happen, but the very fact that's being talked about is something that should worry everybody. And, you know, when Quebec was doing this in the 80s and 90s, early 90s, it was something that was dealt with and dealt with promptly, whereas here in Alberta, we've yet to see anyone in the federal government actually take this seriously. So,
yeah, that's true. And the fact that there could be a national unity crisis happening in the near future, with a lot more resentment and a lot more feelings towards leaving Canada, that's something that should be worrying to especially a lot of Federalist politicians in Ottawa, but also ones across the provinces as well. Any time you have something like that happen, I think it creates a lot of hardship for a lot of people, economically. Actually, we should all be working together and on this. And the fact that the federal government doesn't seem to be wanting to do that for Albertans is definitely quite worrying.
Indeed it is. And we're going to talk more about what the federal government is up to later, but we're going to move on to our BC story first. But before we do that, I'll just take a moment to remind everybody about our Patreon page, which you can find at patreon.com/westerncontext. And that's where you can support the podcast. So for $2 a month, or effectively the price of a cup of coffee, you help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, or the price of a sandwich, you can continue to help us do that, but you can hear your name read out on the podcast if you so desire. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production show notes throughout the week. And when we reach $25 a month in contributions, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month, where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs may be headed next. And when we reach $50 a month, you can expect online town halls hosted every quarter. These topics of discussion will include the news of the month, the state of the media, and your questions. We also do have an option to make a one-time contribution via PayPal. You can find out more about how to do that and the Patreon option at westerncontext.ca/support. All right, so what do we have for BC this week?
All right, so with BC this week, we've got a return to a story that we've covered in the past, and we've definitely covered the BC casino money laundering scandal on Western Context before, but this week, startling revelations were released by a whistleblower who apparently warned a casino of money laundering and organized crime. And a great Canadian gaming employee who was concerned about workplace safety informed the company's founder that she had felt staff had to, quote, accept doing business year after year with what most certainly appears to be some level of cooperation with organized crime. Now, this was coming from former Great Canadian Dealer supervisor Muriel Labine, who sent the complaint letters in January of 2000. That's right, almost two decades ago, to the company's founder and then president, Ross McLeod. Now, McLeod's responses acknowledged that there were, quote, potentially serious allegations in the Richmond casino, and claimed that senior management was working with RCMP and the BC Lottery Corporation in an ongoing investigation. Labine explained how she first noticed what she believed were loan sharks flooding the Richmond casino with suspicious cash after May 1997, when the NDP government at the time first introduced Baccarat and raised casino betting limits from $25 to $500. Betting limits on Baccarat were then raised repeatedly, starting at $500 per hand in 1997 and eventually growing to $100,000 per hand in 2014. Now, according to allegations in Labine's records, some staff believed the dominant loan sharking gang in the Richmond casino was the Big Circle Boys, which is a powerful transnational heroin trafficking cartel rooted in China, Macau, and Hong Kong. Now, the Big Circle Boys are the Asian organized crime kingpins responsible for the so-called Vancouver model of underground banking, which is media speak for money laundering, which police believe is driving Vancouver's housing affordability and fentanyl overdose crisis. Now, with ties to Hong Kong underground banks and drug supply in Burma, the Big Circle Boys control North America's heroin trade, according to federal records. And now, with connections to officials and factories in China, they also dominate the illicit fentanyl trade, police sources say. Now, on January 5th, 2000, as we mentioned, Labine wrote her first letter to McLeod. She said, "As you may know, I am currently on medical stress leave from our Richmond location. In light of all the ongoing activities within our casino, from allegations of sexual harassment to what certainly appears to be illegal activities surrounding the various gangs, I find it at this time very difficult to put myself in an environment which I consider to be unhealthy and unsafe." About a month after Labine's initial complaint, McLeod replied with a detailed response. The letter indicates that McLeod had investigated Labine's claims and spoke with Great Canadian's then Vice President Adrian Thomas, the manager who had previously handled Labine's complaints. McLeod wrote in February 2000, quote, "In your letter, you expressed difficulty in believing that I would not have been informed above what appeared to be illegal activity in our casinos. To the contrary, I have been kept advised on the whole situation since its inception." Now, contrary to Labine's allegation that the company was ignoring her complaints, McLeod's letter claims that Labine and organized union organizers were informed multiple times that Great Canadian Gaming was, quote, "fully aware of the problem," and that initiated contact with and worked with BCLC, RCMP, and the Vancouver Police since the beginning of suspected criminal activities. Now, Labine says that she regrets signing an $18,000 gag order with Great Canadian Gaming that prevented her from speaking at a public hearing regarding the company's application to open a casino in Coquitlam, BC. So what we do know about this scandal is that both past BC NDP and BC Liberal governments have had their hands dirty on this issue, and it's one that's clearly had a jumpstart of many of the crises plaguing BC to this day: the housing affordability crisis, the fentanyl overdose crisis, and certainly organized crime in Vancouver. Now, when the NDP took power almost 2 years ago, I know it's been that long, money laundering was one of the bigger files that was promised to be tackled. The NDP still hasn't started a public inquiry, and RCMP cases on the money laundering file have failed to go to court. Now, former BC Liberal Solicitor General and current MLA Mike Morris has fingered the blame solely on current NDP Attorney General David Eby for compromising a police investigation and collapsing a major money laundering case. However, Morris failed to provide actual proof on the matter. It led to a bitter day in the legislature as the two main parties hurled accusations back and forth. So what's being clear is that this issue is still not being solved, and both parties would rather blame each other than actually get the problem fixed. Hopefully it does very soon, as without 2 decades of inaction, we could have been looking at a very different BC.
And pulling back all the layers on this onion of this scandal, money laundering, and you tie it into the fentanyl cases and the real estate in Vancouver, you have a real problem here. And you seem that many of the issues that Vancouver and the Lower Mainland essentially face are tied to this criminal group of thugs from China focused around money laundering in these casinos. You know, you start off with Baccarat bets at $500 per hand and increase them to $100,000 per hand by 2014. You have to wonder why the government would do that. And, you know, you could say it's probably due to demand, but the government of the day has a responsibility to look into who is requesting these limits be increased. And, you know, you'd think that, you know, going back all the way to January 5th, 2000, something would have been picked up. And this is something that we've been talking about a lot on Western Context. And I think this is a story that goes back the furthest temporally for us all the way to the year 2000. And it's really interesting to look at because if this is cracked, so many other things in BC could be fixed. But yet this government came in 2 years ago, hasn't done anything on yet. And I think the media could ask some questions to that effect to maybe get the ball rolling.
Yeah, I think just the simple fact that this has clearly been a problem since before either of us were even teenagers is clearly something that's a big issue and should have been looked at a long, long time ago, even before the BC Liberals took power in 2001, before the NDP were still in power back in the mid to late 90s. Clearly, this was something that needs to be looked at. And I think just the inaction on this file has snowballed out of the control over the past couple decades, so that the organized crime has had such a huge impact on what's going on in the Lower Mainland, in Vancouver in particular. All of the money from the drug trade has been going into these casinos, money laundered, and a lot of that money is going back into Vancouver real estate. Definitely China has been supplying a lot of the drugs and fentanyl that's been going in through the port of Vancouver. And, you know, there's been a lot of issues in BC that could have been fixed, but something on this file was not being looked at and definitely should have been.
Indeed. And, you know, when it comes to China, China is becoming an increasingly big picture part of Canada's foreign policy, probably even bigger than the U.S. at this point. And that's what our Canada story is about. It's a headline from the Toronto Sun by Brian Lilly that says that SNC haunts us still on steel and trade with China. And, you know, SNC-Lavalin was back in the media this week. But, of course, there are bigger stories, as we heard in our Alberta segment, the new government, the testimony on Parliament Hill and the Senate, and of course that face-to-face meeting between Premier Jason Kenney and Justin Trudeau. Now, we have to ask ourselves with this, what exactly are the Liberals and SNC-Lavalin up to, and how does that tie in with China? Well, it turns out that on August 5th, 2016, a letter marked confidential was sent from the Commissioner of Canadian Elections to the Federal Liberal Party. And those in the media and us here at Western Context just heard about it this week, almost 3 years after the fact. And what was in this letter was a detailing of between 2004 and 2009, 18 SNC-Lavalin employees that contributed $110,000 to the Liberal Party of Canada. Comparatively, only $8,000 was indirectly donated by SNC employees to the Conservative Party. Now, there's nothing wrong with this, of course. People who work for companies are allowed to donate to whatever political party they want. But when you see huge numbers, such as $110,000, that's when eyebrows start to raise. Now, the issue with this is that SNC-Lavalin reimbursed these donations to the Liberal Party in the form of corporate bonuses. It is forbidden for a company to do this in Canada. So what this means is that a bunch of employees and executives were told to donate to the Liberal Party, and then SNC-Lavalin just repaid them in their next paycheck with a corporate bonus. Now, you might be wondering what ridings were targeted. Well, four of them were in Quebec and four Liberal leadership campaigns. Now, let's ask ourselves what was happening in the Liberal Party of Canada, the Federal Liberal Party, between 2004 and 2009. Well, Liberal corruption was being exposed. Paul Martin left as Prime Minister. Stéphane Dion took over the party. He lost the election in 2008. Then Michael Ignatieff took over. And this is covering this entire period where this stuff was going on, where the Liberals claimed to be rebuilding themselves and rebranding themselves. And ultimately, SNC-Lavalin avoided charges in this matter by signing a compliance agreement in 2016 with the Commissioner of Canadian Elections after promising to not break the law again. Now, this might sound familiar to our listeners because, you know, this is exactly what the federal government wanted to do with the deferred prosecution agreement, except that came to light. Now, we also need to compare this with something similar that happened in the Conservative Party with former Conservative MP, Dean Del Mastro, who was charged by the same commissioner for over $21,000 in 2008's election campaign for spending violations. Now, this is one person that was charged over $21,000 compared to 18 executives from a multi-billion-dollar multinational company that was let off the hook by the election commissioner. At the end of the day, only one SNC-Lavalin executive was charged on this matter. Talking to the CBC, Michael Novick, who was charged, denied that these donations actually happened, but we have the list. His name's there. Elections Canada brought the list forward. It happened. The story that everyone should be talking about is why the Liberals covered this up. You know, with the firing of Jody Wilson-Raybould and Jane Philpott, threatening to sue Andrew Scheer, the opposition leader, and shutting down all the committee investigations, this has, of course, taken the full attention of the media and the party to deal with going back to February. Yeah, it's been 3 months now on that matter. And it makes sense why nothing else has come up, even this horrible SNC-Lavalin issue, even though it was related to before Justin Trudeau took over the party and his actions while he was prime minister and overseeing the election commissioner ultimately resulted once again in SNC-Lavalin getting off. Now, as Brian Lilly wrote in the Toronto Sun, events transpired as follows. First and foremost, U.S. Ambassador David McNaughton said that steel and aluminum tariffs would be lifted in a few weeks. And he said this on February 23rd. And this is, of course, the week before Jody Wilson-Raybould first testified. Here we are in May. Those tariffs are still in place. Gerald Butts was ultimately handling the tariff negotiations with the United States, and he resigned, which, of course, leaves no one to continue these talks, and the U.S. has since moved on to other trade deals with China. Number three, Canada is also dealing with China in terms of the Huawei executive, Meng Wanzhou, since December. Our relationship with China has also turned cold recently, seeing Canadians arrested, one now sentenced to death, and China ultimately restricting imports of Canadian canola. They say it's due to quality, but that's how China gets back at different countries. They effectively respond tit for tat. Now, ask yourself, why could this be? Canada told China that, as a country, we are governed by the rule of law. But if you look into the media, you look into any media for the last 3 months, you see that's the complete opposite of what's been happening in the Prime Minister's office. It was also revealed this week that a special deal for SNC-Lavalin, that is the Deferred Prosecution Agreement, is not yet even off the table with this government, despite how much heat they took on the matter. Now, where's the media on this? It should be headline news that SNC-Lavalin has been donating over $100,000 to the Liberal Party, but it's not. Trudeau's Liberals are ultimately operating the same way that they did under Jean Chrétien, Paul Martin, Stéphane Dion, and Michael Ignatieff. The rest of us as taxpayers are ultimately paying the bill for this government obsessed with Quebec companies' issues, whereas issues important to everyday Canadians slip by this government and the media, and Canadians are worse off at the end of it.
Yeah, that's true. And the fact that this SNC scandal is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to Liberal corruption and all of the events going on that have now surfaced in the media, and we're just finding out about all these other sorts of gray area things that have been going on in the Liberal Party, and all of the dots are getting connected on this issue, and definitely it seems like there's more here still to learn, and we keep thinking to ourselves, well, what more is to come on this issue? You know, what haven't we heard? And we keep hearing more and more things all the time.
It's almost as if this is a replay except of the sponsorship scandal in the mid-2000s, except bigger. The only way that all the details in that were brought forward was a public inquiry on the matter, and we know, of course, the Liberals aren't going to call that. They've shut down various committees, and you know, this is, of course, probably going to define the ballot box issue this fall, you know, corruption and ethical government, assuming the Canadian economy is doing reasonably well. And you know, we know that if the economy is not doing well, that will of course take over the ballot question. And you know, you look at public opinion surveys on that, and the government isn't leading in any of these areas, you know, ethics, accountability, or even matters of the economy. And It's going to be a wonder to see how they get through these next 3 to 4 months before the election call actually happens, and to see what kind of actions they take, whether it's something conciliatory to try and move forward to regain public trust, or if it's just going to be steady as she goes, and let's just hope that there's enough scandals that they all get swept under the rug out in a constant stream of media attention.
Yeah, I think, and the reason why Trudeau's popularity has been slipping for sure is partly on why he was elected in the first place. When he got elected, when he was on the TV doing his commercials in the ad campaign, when he was in the leaders' debates, he came across as someone who was very much holier than thou, someone who, preached to rise above what Stephen Harper and the Conservatives and what Thomas Mulcair and the NDP were doing. And he said, "Oh, we're going to have an open, fair elected government. We're going to have a government that puts the people first." That, all these different platitudes that he said and promised all these sorts of things that now have gone by the wayside. And I think people are learning just how much he's promised and how much he hasn't actually done. And now we're finding out all these other things that he's been doing on the side that have definitely not been part of an open and transparent government as he promised. And I think that's definitely going to define something that's going to happen in the fall when we go to an election again.
Yeah, and if you look at this from a communication standpoint, the government can talk about any one of these issues, and if they do, they bring attention to them. That's not what they want. And the alternative is to either just ignore them and hope they go away and someone else makes the news, or the other option is to just keep going forward and bring, two or three different news items forward each week so that everything gets mixed in and jumbled together. And that's what we have this week, not to the credit of the government, just the way that things fell. And, that's one of the things that drove the SNC story, is that there was nothing else to talk about at that time, so much so that drove the main narrative. And that's not happening anymore. So that's why this one kind of got swept away. But we do also have another story that did get swept away and didn't get too much coverage in our firing line segment.
That's true. Swept away almost literally. It was interesting how you were talking about issues that everyday Canadians are more concerned with, and our firing line segment actually has one of those issues. Our firing line segment, of course, being the part of the episode where we talk about a story that's either been misrepresented by the media, not covered fairly, or just completely blown out of proportion. And I think this upcoming story has definitely all parts of all three of those. Now, over the past few weeks, Eastern Canada, specifically parts of New Brunswick, Quebec, and Ontario, have been devastated by severe flooding. We touched on this very briefly last week. Now, rivers, especially the St. John River in New Brunswick and the Ottawa River in Ontario and Quebec, among others, are overflowing with water after a large amount of snowmelt runoff and wet weather has combined to surge rivers well past their normal heights. Now, several communities in the Ottawa to Montreal corridor, as well as Fredericton and St. John in New Brunswick, are still on watch and working hard to save their homes. Tens of thousands remain evacuated, and many homes are still flooded and underwater. Now, the crisis has prompted an outpouring, if you'll pardon the pun, of support across the country, with crowdfunding for victims, the military setting up massive amounts of infrastructure, and massive amounts of volunteers working around the clock to fill sandbags and provide aid to neighbors that are directly affected by the floods. Politicians have also stopped in to help volunteers, help being in quotations, of course, the price being a few photo ops. As well. Now, Ontario Premier Doug Ford and Quebec Premier François Legault have been working with volunteers, and the military have shown up in affected areas. Prime Minister Trudeau was also on hand to visit a West End Ottawa community, joined by his sons Xavier, who is 11, and Hadrian, who is 5, to pick up a shovel and fill up a few sandbags, with the cameras rolling, of course. Now, Trudeau was briefed by officials in charge of the fight against the flood at a community center before filling sandbags and thanking those who came to the aid of local residents. "Thank you for doing what you're doing," Trudeau said as he and his sons spoke with volunteers working around a large sand pile. However, not everyone appreciated Trudeau's efforts to encourage others to help out flood-stricken families. As he was shaking hands with military personnel and volunteers in Constance Bay shortly after photo op where everyone was smiling, the riverfront village west of downtown Ottawa that has seen the worst flooding so far. A local resident confronted the Prime Minister to complain that his visit and photo ops had held up trucks from getting to the sandbags, and that he had to wait for upwards of 30 minutes just to get to the staging area. The unidentified man said, quote, "You and your security are blocking the roads. What you're doing is insincere." The man, who identified himself as a volunteer, voiced his frustrations with Trudeau, dismissing his presence as a photo op and blaming the Prime Minister's security for long waits for people looking to obtain sandbags. He said, quote, "Do you know how long you've held up people picking up bags?" the man asked Trudeau. He said, quote, "I've been waiting in line down the road for 30 minutes while you've been here soaking up the rays. While you're here, no one can pick up sand. You held people up. All of the security and RCMP held people up." Now, Trudeau initially ignored the volunteer, then went over to apologize to him and responded by saying he understood the frustrations with security that accompanies the Prime Minister wherever he goes, and that his aim was to encourage more Canadians to volunteer. Now, Trudeau's executive assistant, Philip Prue, was quick to go onto Twitter to say that the RCMP, quote, "confirmed to us on site that no trucks had been blocked. Trucks were pulling up one after the other to get sandbags while the PM was there. I know because I helped put sandbags in some of those trucks." Now, what CBC, Global, and the others have failed to note, even though that the video evidence was right there, was that the volunteer was being pushed away by a female member of Trudeau's staff before Trudeau himself turned around to acknowledge the disgruntled volunteer by saying, "I'm sorry for your challenge." The volunteer replied, "It's not my challenge. I'm a volunteer trying to help someone save their home." And at the end of the tirade, the volunteer said, "This was the most sincere thing I've ever seen," and turns away. The Prime Minister then has the gall to say, "That's unfriendly and unneighborly here today," even though he was a volunteer helping others. It just goes to show that it seems that Trudeau can't even get through an entire week without having some sort of oops moment. Now, there are still 24 weeks until the next federal election. We'll just have to see how many of them are weeks where Trudeau says or does something dumb.
You know, I read this story and I knew we'd be covering it on the show for probably firing line, especially after seeing this on video. And I said to myself, and I think I said to you, that, you know, if Trudeau wants a better chance at getting reelected, perhaps he should just stay in his office until October election day to see what happens with this. Because, you know, there is no need for this to be happening when you go out to obviously try and, of course, put a good face forward and show the communities that you stand with them. But the very fact that this happened is inexcusable, and it should have garnered some media coverage on this issue, because at the end of the day, it's the Prime Minister. And if the Prime Minister makes life worse for Canadians by policy, that's one thing. Obviously, they try not to do that. But if the Prime Minister actually goes out and his actions in the real world, let's just say, outside of the office, actually do cause these kind of issues, that's a bigger problem and something that he and his staff should definitely seek to mitigate.
Yeah, exactly. And this was something that actually did see some media attention, was that the whole confrontation with the volunteer was taking place. But it was interesting how in their summaries on the articles, many of the news organizations, such as CBC and Global, just didn't talk about what Trudeau said to the volunteer at the end, was that he was being unneighborly and unhelpful, and the fact, or unfriendly. And the fact that that was something that was said, and that the media didn't end up covering that, even though the video was right there, even on their own websites, was definitely quite something, when that was quite clearly the most newsworthy part of the entire segment.
Yeah, and you know, you compare this to some coverage you see in the U.S. I know during the 2016 campaign, there were whole news stories that took up that Donald Trump ate chicken with a fork and knife, for some fried chicken with a fork and knife, and that occupied media coverage. Whereas, you know, we see something here that is an actual transgression against someone, and it just gets swept away. So.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, what would have a headline looked like if it said, in quotation marks, "unfriendly and unneighborly, Trudeau slams volunteers helping flood victims"? You know, what would that look like? I mean, if they had gone with that, but instead it's Trudeau accused of delaying sandbagging, you know, and it's definitely different ways to spin an article and different ways to spin a headline. And I think that the media in this particular case did not cover the article fairly enough, and I think that's why it's our firing line.
Indeed, and this story and all the others this week bring us to our word of the week, which is particularly apt.
That's true, and when I was looking through this, I thought, well, sandbagging definitely means one thing, where they were to put things into sandbags to help protect a boat against a flood, but it actually has another meaning, and that's to either treat unfairly or harshly, to coerce by crude means, or to conceal or misrepresent one's true position, potential, or intent, especially in order to gain an advantage over someone else. And I think we can definitely take this to apply to our firing line segment, in which Trudeau was definitely misrepresenting his true position or intent by going out to try and help, in quotations, flood victims, when in reality he was only there for half an hour, maybe an hour at best, and got a few photo ops out of it to put on Twitter. And I think we could see this in the other stories where the media has definitely been taking different positions and misrepresenting them unfairly in order to gain the advantage.
Yeah, and you know, whether that's not bringing forward the full story of what's happening with the Alberta negotiations on Bill C-69 and you know, the full economic impact that we can see from that ultimately leading to issues and people in Alberta thinking of separation. And that's something that the media should be representing properly, but they aren't. And that's why that was here on the show this week as well. And even in BC, you know, we see stories going back all the way to the year 2000 when it comes to money laundering in BC. You know, we had the new government in BC almost 2 years ago at this point take power. Nothing's been done. Media could go forward on that and represent those stories properly as well. And that's what we've been here doing for the entire time we've been doing this podcast since January 2017 here at Western Context. And we hope to continue that going forward. And you can find full show notes for this episode and all of the episodes at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes or any other podcast listener out there. Head on over to westerncontext.ca/subscribe to learn how to do that. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook, where we share all the stories that we're looking at throughout the entire week at Western Context on both those platforms. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always make sure to look through all the stories that the mainstream media talks about and some that they don't talk about to make sure that we can cut through all that bias and sensationalism that we always see in the mainstream media, whatever they're talking about, either in politics or even not politics, just to make sure that we can give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we will see you next week for another episode of Western Context.